from WCVB Channel 5 podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. Today's guest, Red Sox Chief Baseball Officer Chaim Bloom. He joins us to talk about a Red Sox team that's in playoff position but has had a rough go of it since the trade deadline. He also tells us why it's wrong to assume that he's building the Red Sox in the image of his former employer, the Tampa Bay Rays. He talks to us about why he believes you can't win just by whipping out your wallet. And also, he defends what he did at the trade deadline. He tells us why he doesn't feel like he shortchanged this year's team at the deadline for the future. Another question we asked Chaim, what can be done about the Red Sox dreadful defense of late? And also, Ellen, he seemed pretty confident that Xander Bogaerts will be a Red Sox into the future. And that's a really, really costly signing potentially for the Red Sox when you look at where that shortstop market has gone.
Yeah, towards the end of the podcast, we got into talking about that. And he sounded pretty confident in the fact that they would do whatever it would take to keep him. I would assume within reason. Again, he said you can't fix the problems just by whipping out your wallet.
Yep.
I don't believe that's the case. But it sounds like Xander's here to stay.
It kind of sounds like, I'm going to botch this lyric, but you know the Ariana Grande lyric from Seven Rings, where she basically says, whoever said money can't solve all your problems didn't have enough money to solve them.
Exactly.
I mean, that's kind of the way it works in baseball. And I feel like Chaim's fighting that a little bit, just a little bit, when you have the resources of the Boston Red Sox. But look, the reason he got hired is because they felt that Dave Dombrowski was spending way too freely, that he was profligate. So that's sort of part of the charge of Chaim Bloom. Bogaerts has that opt out after the 2022 season. That shortstop market, man, teach your kid to play shortstop if you have kids someday, Ellen, because Francisco Lindor signed a 10-year, $341 million deal, and that set the market at that position.
I can confidently say if I ever have children one day, they will not be athletic. So
no, maybe, you don't
No. I might teach them how to like do math, and they'll be the GM or something.
Oh, well, you know what? That's pretty good.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. If you have a son or daughter that ends up being like Chaim Bloom, that would be pretty good.
Yes.
He is a Yale grad. So
yes.
Yes, the Red Sox chief baseball officer breaks it down for us on the Take 5 podcast. You're going to want to hear from him on the state of the Red Sox. He's next.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike
Once
Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
All right, now, as promised, we're joined by Boston Red Sox Chief Baseball Officer Chaim Bloom. Chaim, thanks for joining us here on the Take 5 podcast. How's it going today?
I'm doing all right. Appreciate you having me on.
So I want to ask you this and start here. I know a lot of teams have proprietary systems where they try and project as best they can what their team will be, what their players will do. When you look at your system with the Red Sox, has this Red Sox team exceeded the internal projections you guys had before the year?
Well, you know, I think one thing that stands out, obviously, notwithstanding the COVID issues we're going through right now, you know, we've had, you know, we managed for the bulk of the season to stay remarkably healthy. And so I think that's allowed us to perform, you know, on the higher end of what you might expect just because our players have been available. And, you know, some of that is just the bounces of the game, good fortune. And some of it, I think, is due to the medical staff and the work of the players themselves. So I think that's helped. We viewed this group coming into the season as a group that was going to be competitive and that had a lot of upside. And that we see how far that took us. And I think everything we saw coming into spring training and going through camp made us feel more strongly about the group. They obviously came out of the gate and validated that. And the season's been a roller coaster. But overall, we've been pretty happy with where they put us.
Yeah, I mean, you should be pretty happy. Here you are, 20 games to go in the season and in possession of the number one wild card spot. I think it's going to be a tight race the rest of the way, obviously, with two other very good teams in your division in terms of the Yankees and the Toronto Blue Jays. I wanted to ask you just on that theme of sort of projections, what a game last night for Hunter Renfroe. I think people are calling it the Hunter Renfroe game. Here's a guy who was DFA'd last year and has been a great value signing for you guys. $3.1 million, having a tremendous year, 16 outfield assists, 267, 27 homers, 85 RBIs. Here's your chance to take a bow. Did you know he was going to do this? Did you know you were getting this sort of value when you signed him in the offseason?
Well, first of all, I don't believe in bows or victory laps. This game is incredibly humbling, and it's never a good idea to do that. But, you know, the talent was there. I mean, you look at what Hunter's done in his career, and everything we've seen on the field has been there at various points in his career. Now, it happened last year. He didn't have a very good year in a short season. And he picked it up a lot in the playoffs. He played great in the postseason. All the ability to do what he's done is stuff that he showcased in the past. Now, you don't know how someone's going to put it together when they come into a new environment. What I think has been especially great to watch is how well he's taken our right field, which might be the most difficult right field in the game. That's a credit to the work he's put in and just how much he cared about learning the nuances of Fenway Park. And that's something you don't know before you acquire somebody.
Yeah, no, he's certainly been a really, really good fit. I mean, you mentioned some of the COVID issues that you guys have gone through here. How have you been able to navigate that? At one point, you had 11 guys on the COVID IL.
Yeah, this has been certainly one of the most unique and in some ways probably one of the most difficult challenges that I've encountered in my career, just on a number of levels. Obviously, the competitive aspect of it, the roster management aspect has been really unique and something that, because we haven't played through a pandemic, and I don't think anybody's played through this sort of an outbreak, something we haven't that I haven't dealt with before. But even beyond that, just, you know, what it means for an organization, how you navigate it. And trying to, you know, walk the walk of all the things that we say about health and safety and caring for players, caring for staff. That's difficult when everybody's congregating every day, you know, playing through a pandemic. But it really has been great to see the way that our players, our staff have rallied, the tireless work of our medical staff. It's unbelievable how much goes on behind the scenes every day to make this go, even when there are no COVID cases. And when you are playing through what we're playing through, it adds to the work, it adds to the stress, knowing how personally everybody takes it, especially on our medical staff. It's a lot to carry. And I'm just so grateful that we have all those folks on our side.
So I guess Hunter had some comments on WEEI today. Hi, I'm about sort of how you guys have dealt with this pandemic. Hunter basically said MLB basically told us to stop the testing and just treat the symptoms. Do you know anything about that in terms of your outbreak?
I didn't hear what he said, so it's hard for me to know the context or if something was misconstrued. But you know, basically, long and short of it, we've been following the protocols all along, and then when you get in a situation like this, stay in close contact with MLB about what to do. Now, in normal situations, the way the protocols switched mid-year, fully vaccinated players are not normally tested unless they show symptoms. Now, when you get in a situation like this, where you have obviously an issue on your club with COVID and you have an outbreak, things change. And, you know, in some ways, you know, the playbook now becomes just communicating real closely with MLB, staying in contact with them on, you know, both the opinions of our medical staff, the opinions of their experts on what do we need to do to keep everybody safe, to make sure that we have found where the virus is, that we've isolated those folks, and of course, that we're able to treat them. And so we've stayed in close touch with them. That has included a ton of testing. And they've been really supportive of our medical staff. There's been great communication with them. So, you know, not having heard all the context of that, it's hard for me to comment, but suffice it to say they've been in lockstep with us for a while now on this, and there's been a ton of testing of everybody in our travel party.
I mean, it sort of feels like you guys are maybe coming out the other side of this. I mean, getting Kike back, I know, was huge for you guys.
Yeah, I hope so. Obviously, we are very hopeful. You know, you never know with this thing. What we're learning is that it can be very hard to pin down because sometimes, you know, the virus could potentially evade testing. You know, there have been a couple points during this when we thought we might be through it, when we thought we might have it contained, and then you find out that you don't. So we're not counting any chickens, so to speak. But what we do know is that, you know, a lot of the guys who did go into isolation when they tested positive are, coming back out of that. And hopefully that will continue. I think, I hope we don't have to deal with much more of this, or with any more of it. But we have, for better or worse, gotten a lot of practice trying to take care of guys and making sure we're taking care of their health, and that we're also making sure they're as ready as they can be to come back. You know, we saw with Kike the first game, I'm sure he wouldn't tell you he was out of sorts, but he looked a little bit out of sorts. And then we saw yesterday You know, he hit the ball in the screws a few times, made a great catch, looked like himself. So that's really encouraging.
So I want to switch it back to baseball a little bit here. I'm just curious, in your experience here now as chief baseball officer, what do you have, you know, philosophically that you've taken from Tampa Bay and brought here that you feel like, okay, you know, that still applies, even though it's a wildly different market with different resources? And what have you learned maybe doesn't apply that you would, you thought maybe would apply bringing from the Rays organization, which, you know, I think is one of the best run organizations in baseball in terms of the success relative to the resources?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think a lot of that, answering that question kind of depends on, you know, sir, how do you, what does it mean for something to apply? I think when you step back and you look at a lot of what we tried to do when I was with the Rays and what, you know, from everything I can see, they are continuing to apply very well, is really just, you know, understanding your situation, understanding the advantages that you have, and trying like hell to win with those advantages. And, you know, to leave no stone unturned in terms of looking for different ways to win. Now, what that means is going to be different from one situation to another. So the advantages and the disadvantages that might exist in Tampa Bay are going to be different from the advantages and disadvantages that exist in Boston. So if you're just trying to take something right from one situation and plop it into another, you know, that's not going to work as well. But I also think that isn't how we looked at the challenge with the Rays. We looked at it as, let's look at the landscape and let's be realistic and resourceful about how we can win, you know, with everything that's available to us. So that, to me, is something that can apply in every situation. I think the biggest thing that applies that has also been a strength of this organization over time is the importance of people and the importance of culture. Everything that happens in Tampa Bay is at its root the product of an incredibly strong organization, top to bottom, where there's a clear mission. There are great people. They work really, really well together. That, to me, is the backbone of success, of lasting success anywhere in this game, and probably, you know, I would imagine in any business. Now, the environment here is very different, and that changes in some cases what you can and can't do. It changes, you know, the microscope you're under is different. And so it means there might be different considerations, different costs, so to speak, of doing some different things. And you have to be realistic about those. You can't allow outside noise to change your mind on what you think is the right decision, but you do have to factor in the effects that that might have. And, you know, you have to factor some things in terms of the environment and what it means to do certain things in a different environment. If you don't, you know, again, I think we would just be ignoring our situation, and that wasn't something that was going to work down there, and it's not something that's going to work up here.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. And here's sort of, I think, I just want to give you a little bit of a chance to set the record straight, and I think you did right there. I think there's this perception, and we all know that perceptions can be wrong, but they can also become reality even when they're not accurate. There's this perception, I think, that you're sort of this strict ideologue, you know, bringing the Tampa Bay Rays way to the Boston Red Sox and sort of just following this blueprint exactly.
Yeah, again, I don't necessarily know what that means. If somebody believes that, I would have to ask them what they mean. You know, the Rays are trying to win. They're trying to win in the situation that they're in with everything they've got. That's what we should be trying to do also. But our situation's different, so there are different ways to go about it. I think the biggest thing there, the biggest lesson that I think can apply everywhere is to be willing to follow what you think is going to work and to be unafraid to do something bold or different if you think it is the best way to win.
So I remember this comment because I actually asked you the question. This was back, I believe, on June the 6th. And we were talking a little bit about what had framed your thinking in the Andrew Benintendi deal and bringing back Franchi Cordero in that deal. And you had maybe the quote of the year, which was saying you can't build a team just by whipping out your wallet. And I think that one kind of caught on a little bit. Just sort of curious, how do you look at the vast resources that the Red Sox have? And for me, I look at it and say one of the real advantages you or anybody in the position that you're in baseball operations has over a team like the Rays is that if you are bold and you make a mistake with those resources, it's not crippling because you actually have the money and the resources to be able to sort of write off some of your mistakes. So how do you look at having that big wallet that you now have in Boston that you didn't have down in St. Petersburg?
Yeah, I think the biggest aspect of that is it makes your menu longer. You have access to a much bigger array of options, whether that's on the free agent market, whether that's by trade, different things that you can do. You know, it's certainly an advantage that you can use, and you have to use it as much as you can. You know, like I said, in our situation, in any situation, you should be fully aware of all the advantages that you have, and you should be willing to use them and to push them to the limit. You know, I think it's also important to remember, you know, and this is what I was getting at when I said that, and I think it's borne out by the history here. Every championship team in this town has been built on a solid foundation that was multifaceted, that in many respects was homegrown. A lot of players that came up through the system, players that were acquired through productive trades, players that were acquired by mining every possible avenue for talent. And I think that really, when you look around the game, if you want to win, and especially if you want to win year in, year out, you have to do that. And money helps with that. Money also helps with that in terms of building up a first-class infrastructure, having the right personnel in place, having the best information, having good facilities, you know, making sure you are, you know, running out every possible advantage you can get, whether it's on the nutrition front, on the medical front, technology. And that's something that, you know, many organizations, this one, the Rays, have done historically very well. But the biggest thing to me is building that foundation, that sustainable foundation. There's no other way to win year in, year out without that.
Where do you feel like you guys are at in terms of building that sustainable foundation? I know sustainability has become a big mantra in the Red Sox organization. Where are you guys at with that? And is that a factor in the fact that up to this point, you haven't given out a contract that's longer than 2 years to anybody?
Well, I think our position keeps improving, but you know, we've still got work to do. And you know, part of the nature of this is it's not like you're ever done, where you say, okay, you know what, we're done. Now we don't have to worry about that stuff anymore. I think if you want to be a really great organization, you need to worry about it constantly. You will get what you emphasize, and if you don't take care of that, you will eventually lose that foundation, and it becomes a lot harder to win without it. And you look at the organizations that are in the postseason every single year, that put themselves in position to win a championship every single year, they are constantly replenishing their team with players that they grow, players that they acquire, you know, through many different means. And we have to do that too. Now, as far as how that's interacted in our, you know, free agent pursuits, I don't think so. I think, like I said, we have access to a bigger menu here, and we're always going to vet all those possibilities. To me, it really just comes down to what makes sense, what fits into what we're trying to do. We're trying to have an elite organization that puts itself in position to win a championship every year. There's no reason that longer or bigger commitments can't play into that. They just need to make sense in the context of what our options are, where we're at, what else we can, you know, what else we can do with our roster spots, what else we can do with our resources, and you know, we go from there.
So I know obviously you've heard a lot about the trade deadline and what you did and what people maybe feel you didn't do. When you look at your team since the trade deadline, they're 17-20. Since the trade deadline, the relievers ERA is 5.50, which is 28th out of 30 teams in Major League Baseball. At the All-Star break, your relievers were at 3.54, eighth in baseball, 91 appearances at the break. Only the Padres had more. Do you, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, wish maybe you'd done a little more for the bullpen, just given how much those guys were relied upon and used and sort of, I know you can't predict COVID for Matt Barnes, but it does seem like your bullpen is burned out a little bit.
Yeah, there, you know, look, I think it's important to say anytime, you know, whether it's an off season or during a season, you're always going to look back and look at things you could have done differently. You know, we're of course going to do that. And by no means are we saying we're going to get everything right. We're not. We're going to try like heck to do that. And we're going to learn from the things that we don't get right. What I think is important, though, is to make sure that we're separating you know, reality from narrative. I think it's real easy, you know, after a trade deadline, I think a lot of stories get written, a lot of stuff gets out there, where, you know, stuff is interpreted a certain way. And then, you know, when it plays out in such a way that fits that interpretation, you know, it kind of feeds that, that fire. I think there are plenty of things that we can look back on differently. You know, we're happy with what we did. There's opportunities that, you know, we let go by that I'm very happy we did let go by. I think a lot of the clamoring out there for us to go run down player X or player Y, I'm not sure those guys would have done any better than what we had. There's other things that we were working on that didn't come to fruition, some of which I wish had, but we just couldn't align. No, that's just the nature of this thing. Obviously, you always want to help as much as you can. But I think you when you start getting away from actually making solid baseball moves that fit what you're trying to do, you end up chasing a ghost. And I don't think you help yourself in the long run.
Were the prices a little higher at the deadline than maybe you expected? I think that's sort of been an industry-wide feeling that for whatever reason this year, maybe prices were a little higher. This is my personal opinion on this. I sort of feel like we've reached maybe a tipping point where prospects are becoming a little bit sort of overvalued. I know at one point you talked about trying to buy a house in this area. And the question is, do you want the house or not? It's not about the value because it's overvalued. Was that a little bit maybe the case at the trade deadline?
Yeah, it was definitely more of a seller's market than I think we've seen in recent deadlines. There are a lot of different reasons for that. But, you know, look, obviously, you would always, they're always, you know, when prices are low, you always want to buy more of anything. But I don't necessarily think that really ruled our decision making at the deadline. We were, again, you know, we find ourselves in the market we find ourselves in, and you want to try to make good baseball moves that align with your goals, that help you win, and that make sense for the organization.
I want to read back to you a quote that you had at the trade deadline, you know, talking about the moves you made. And we're going to get to Kyle Schwarber in a second, because I think I know you said you're not going to take bows or pat yourself on the back. But I know that's one that's worked out really well and where you guys have been right. But you said, and this is part of the quote here, you know, if we want the future to be really good, you have to take care of the future and you have to care about it. You also said within that quote, we know how hard it is to get to this position. We don't take that for granted. I understand you're walking a little bit of a tightrope, but sort of by definition, when it comes to prioritization, you really can only prioritize one thing. At the end of the day, was there more of a priority on protecting sustainability in the future than going all out to upgrade this team? Just, you know, looking at actions, you know, actions speak louder than words. It's sort of hard to look at it any other way.
Yeah, I don't think we ever thought of it in those terms. And I really still don't. You know, I think anytime you are making the types of moves we made at the deadline, you're definitionally prioritizing the now. It's still really just a question of making good moves within that. You know, we've been obviously thrilled, as I think everybody who cares about this team has been thrilled with what Kyle Schwarber has done. Now, if we had, you know, to give you an extreme example, if we had, regardless of what Kyle Schwarber has done, if we had emptied out our entire farm system to acquire him, I don't think anybody would consider that a good baseball move. So it really gets down to, we're trying to win as much as possible. And what allows us to do that? Sometimes within that, there's a tug of war between the now and the future. Again, I think definitionally when you are adding at the deadline, when you're in a position to add at the deadline, you're turning the dial towards the now. You just still want to make good trades while doing it.
Yeah. So you touched on Kyle. I definitely want to touch on him. He's had a huge impact. And I feel like maybe some of this sort of got lost just because he couldn't play July 31st and the deadline was July 30th. You guys had to wait a little while. But Kyle Schwarber, since he's come to the Red Sox, 999 OPS, 165 OPS plus, on base percentage is 455, which is the second best in baseball since August the 13th. He's also come up with some huge hits. Is this what you expected from him when you added this bat to the lineup? Because people sort of question a little, oh man, you know, offensively, the Red Sox are a juggernaut. Why do they need more offense? But he's really made a difference, not only with the numbers, but just the influence he's had on the lineup.
Yeah, you nailed it. We talked about it going into the deadline that sometimes adding to a strength is just as important as patching a hole. And it's not just the results, which, you know, we knew he was a good hitter. We felt really, really strongly that this guy, like I said, the day we acquired him, was as good a hitter as changed hands at the trade deadline. But you can't expect this out of anybody. I mean, this is, you know, what he's done has been amazing. And more than that, he's been every bit of the person that we thought he would be. And the teammate that he is, combined with the maturity that he has, the approach that he shows, I think it's really been helpful for a lot of our hitters just to see him, to see how he handles an at bat. He's been great to have.
Is Bobby Dalbec one of those guys? Because I don't know, coincidentally or not, you know, during the same time period, he has really, really taken off. Since August 13th, he actually has the highest OPS in baseball. And I can't even believe this number. 1,221. He's batting .328 with 9 home runs. Is that just Bobby getting more comfortable, or has Kyle had an influence on him?
You know, you probably have to ask Bobby just to get inside his head a little bit. I think Kyle's had a great influence on everybody, but I don't think we should take credit away from Bobby. This has been an adjustment that he's been working on really the whole time, where you could see really the first 2/3 of the season, his timing was off and it was impacting just his ability to make quality contact. We know how much damage he can do when he makes quality contact. There's going to be some swing and miss to Bobby Dalbec's game. That is the case, but it's really just a question of how much. And we see when he's on time, he's able to drive pitches he should drive, how much damage he can do. And I think with that, you've seen his confidence increase. His whole game has been elevated really during that stretch, because I think he's finally starting to feel comfortable. You know, you never know when the light is going to go on for somebody. I think we're fooling ourselves to think that we can know exactly when that's going to be, even when we know these players really well. They're human beings. We don't have a crystal ball here. It's just been great to see him mature as a hitter and see him go through this and go through some struggles and find his way out of them.
Chaim, you're very good at blocking out the noise of this market, you know, even though you've only been in it a couple of years. But honestly, is it a little bit tougher to stick with a Bobby Dalbec in this market than maybe it would be in Tampa or a smaller market with less scrutiny?
It's a good question. I mean, from a standpoint of, you know, our own competitiveness, I feel strongly, having had experiences in different markets, having been part now of different front offices, you know, none of that stuff, the environment in the market fuels that competitiveness in the sense that we all want to win really, really badly as is. I do think, you know, when there is that kind of noise, the thing you worry about is, you know, what it could mean if it gets in the house, so to speak, is making sure that players are in a good place to perform. Look, every player who cares is going to feel some kind of responsibility to his teammates. That's already a lot to shoulder. You know, we just want to make sure we're putting these players in the best position to succeed. This place is not for everybody, but it's our job to make sure we help everybody get in the best place to succeed so that they can thrive off that pressure. They can feel it as the wind in their backs when they're performing well, and be able to focus on the day-to-day of what they need to do when things aren't going as well, so they can get back on track.
Going to bring in producer Ellen Fleming now, Chaim. She's going to ask you sort of something really very related to that point that we just talked about.
So do you feel like there are any players that were a good fit from an analytic standpoint, but just because of the nature of playing in Boston, they weren't the right fit for this city?
Yeah, great question. Obviously, some of those things are not things that you're going to be able to sift through a bunch of numbers and find. And that's why with anybody that we contemplate acquiring, you want to get to know the person as much as you can. And when they're somebody else's player, you don't always have the chance to do that. That's where the background work we do comes in. That's where the work of our scouts comes in. That's where our networks come in. I do think we should pride ourselves on having an environment that can get the most out of any player. But I do think that there are some players who aren't going to enjoy the things that make this market unique. There are some players that are going to thrive off of those things. And we've all seen examples of players historically in this town who fit in both columns. Our job is to be able to separate one from the other. Now, just because a player underperforms doesn't mean that he's not suited to play in Boston. It could just be that he had an off year. It could be that something else was going on. But in some cases, you know, again, they're human. We're all human, and different people thrive in different environments. Our job is just to separate those two. So I would say absolutely. I don't know that we are going to be able to have perfect knowledge of who that is in advance or even watching it play out. But our job is to separate that as best as we can.
Great answer there. I want to ask you about some of the defensive issues your team has had. I think that they really sort of came to a head on Labor Day against the Tampa Bay Rays in what was really a crushing loss, having a 7-1 second inning lead and then losing in extra innings. 3 errors in that game, 2 very costly misplays. I was surprised. I didn't know this, Chaim, but you guys are currently 3rd in Major League Baseball in most errors made at 94. We talked about Bobby Dalbec. I think the defense has improved, but out of 119 players who have played at least 20 innings at first base this season, he's dead last, according to Fangraphs, in defensive runs saved at -7. There's also some other positions where you guys are low. Shortstop, -5, that's 20th. Third base, 25th, -8, according to Fangraphs. I know internally, every organization has their own proprietary evaluation of defense. But is defense a major issue for this team? And how do you balance your offense and getting the best defensive team you can on the field at this point?
Yeah, look, I mean, obviously we all watch the games. I'm not, there's no argument there that we have not been the defensive team that we would hope to be. There's been different reasons for that. It's looked different at different times. In some cases, it's been that we haven't made plays that should be made. And then there's other cases where, every team can separate itself by making some plays that are not necessarily routine plays that in certain instances, you know, certain guys, certain situations we made, and then sometimes we haven't. That is what it is. It's something that we could certainly stand to improve. It's not for lack of effort, but it is the case. I think it's difficult to argue with that. When we are playing up to our capabilities defensively, we can do a lot of good things on the field. We haven't always done that. There have been games, like you pointed out, where it has gotten ugly. Again, the season's going to have peaks and valleys, but if we want to be who we want to be and we want to get where we want to go, we're going to have to be better than that. There are certain cases where you make those offense defense trade-offs. Look, runs are runs. It still helps to score runs. It also helps to prevent them. Hopefully we're striking the right balance. We're just, the basic goal is I don't think it pays to get too mired in necessarily thinking about the trade-off in a vacuum, just looking at every game, what's in front of us on a given day and saying, how can we put ourselves in best position to have more runs than the other team at the end of it?
It is really that simple. When you break it down like that. Also, just on that subject, I want to ask you, when you look at some of this stuff, again, I'm quoting Fangraphs, but I know every team has their own proprietary sort of system of evaluating defense. It's one of the last great frontiers, I think, in analytics at this point. Fangraphs says Xander Bogaerts is a -7 DRS at shortstop. Endeavors is a -7 as well. Do you feel like that's fair, or do you guys have metrics that say, they're closer to average or maybe even above average defenders?
Yeah, there's some, without getting into too much detail, there are some areas where our internal metrics differ from what's available publicly. Look, at the end of the day, I think it's been pretty much at times everywhere on the diamond where there are plays that we should have made that we haven't made. And I don't know that any of our players would tell you any differently. And you see, especially with those two guys, how much they care. You can see just watching them how much they wear it when they don't make a play. So there's definitely meat on the bone there to improve and to take our game to the next level. Now, we also see with both those guys how good it looks when they are making those plays. So we know it's in there, and it's just a question of, are we going to be able to establish that consistency the rest of the way to play at our peak so we can make all the plays we need to make.
I know a big charge when you were brought in was to improve the farm system. And this year, Baseball America came out with the midseason rankings. You guys jumped all the way up to 9th from 20th. Is that a reflection of improvement in the system, or is that maybe just the rest of the industry catching up to the evaluations you guys had of your farm system?
History has taught me, A, not to get too focused on those external rankings, but also not to, I think sometimes when you start believing that you've got some big secret that you're beating the rest of the industry, but nobody knows it, you often get humbled when you start believing that. But at the end of the day, I don't know that it necessarily pays for us to compare too much to any of that stuff. We have to keep improving no matter where we are. We should act like we're 30th all the time in terms of how much we want to improve. Now, I do think we have improved through a combination of things. I think in some cases, we've been able to add talent through various means. I think there's other cases where we've had players that have taken steps forward that were already under our control. Some guys who emerged from the pandemic in a much better place than they were before. Some guys who are out there exceeding expectations. Certainly that hasn't been every single player across the board. There's been ups and downs, but I think on the whole, we've been pretty happy with how our players came out of the shutdown.
Yeah, I mean, the farm system, I think, is one of the real bright spots for the Boston Red Sox this year. And I know Worcester's been on a pretty good run as well. I know AAA is not necessarily as developmental as some of the other levels, but they've certainly have played well. I did want to ask you about, and I swear I didn't pick this guy on purpose because he's having a bad season, but just because I'm interested in him as a player. Jeter Downs was a guy I had pretty high hopes for this year. He's had a little bit of a rough year at Worcester. Right now, 179, 260, 570 is the slash line. What have you guys seen from him? Is there maybe something that belies the numbers in his development that's a positive?
Yeah, no question it hasn't played out for Jeter this year the way anybody had hoped, including him. I think the good news is all the physical ability is still there. You know, we've spent a bunch of time on this internally, a bunch of time with him, different reasons for why he struggled. We have identified some things that I think we are working towards a better place from a swing and approach standpoint. You know, I think some of this, you know, does date back to just having some difficulty getting him on track, even dating back to last year. You know, some of it, we did challenge him with a really aggressive assignment where he had basically spent almost no time at AA and he got the time at the alternate site. Now here he is in AAA. Again, I think all the physical ability is still there. We don't think any differently about that or about how he's wired and what the makeup could allow him to achieve. But we do need to get him back on track. He knows that. We know that. I think we've actually made some headway, even though it hasn't shown in the results yet the last few weeks, making some meaningful adjustments to allow him to be on time more, to allow his swing to work a little bit better so we can get back to damaging the baseball. So I'm encouraged by where the arrow is pointing. But, you know, we know obviously what he's done this year isn't what we expected and isn't a reflection of the ceiling that he has.
You know, he's a big part, obviously, of the Mookie Betts deal. And I think that's a deal you will be associated with for better or worse for a long time. Alex Verdugo has played very well. I do want to revisit that deal just a little bit as we get near the end here. And a question that's always been in my mind is, obviously, originally, Bruzdar Gratterall, I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, but he was part of that deal. So you were getting some pitching back in the deal. But then when the deal was finalized, there was not a pitcher in there. When I look at the Dodgers and their depth there and the fact they were able to take a guy like Josiah Gray and flip him for Max Scherzer, Tony Gonsolin's there. I know Dustin Mays had Tommy John, Andre Jackson's come up. How close did you come to getting a pitcher in the deal? And why didn't you get a pitcher when you're trading somebody like Mookie Betts to the Dodgers? You know, why not get somebody who can be a starter that you can plug into your rotation potentially down the line when you're giving up something so valuable?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And look, I don't think it's appropriate to get into too much detail about the coulda, woulda, shoulda of any trade. I don't think it's fair to, you know, to other clubs or really to players involved who, you know, may or may not have been involved in different permutations of the deal. What I will say, I think this is true for most trades. It was certainly true of this one, that there, before a deal gets to the finish line, there are so many different versions that get discussed and a lot of different names change hands. Obviously, you need to find something that everybody can agree upon. That is, you know, it's not a bank robbery, it's a trade. So, you know, there were so many different things that were discussed, and certainly there were pitchers whose names were mentioned in the talks that we had. I think at the end of the day, we decided that the most important thing in terms of assessing our return was just the amount of talent that came back. And while, you know, pitching is obviously important, I think if you start working too much off of need all the time, you end up just shorting yourselves on the talent front. So we basically pursued the path that we thought would maximize the talent we could bring back. We cared about that more than making a certain position fit. You know, you have to be pretty loaded to start not being able to capitalize on having talented players. So there are a lot of different, you know, versions of that deal that could have happened, but we just wanted to bring back the most talent that we could. You know, I think it's interesting that you mentioned Josiah Gray. I think one of the things that's worth pointing out is the deal. Josiah Gray came to the Dodgers in the same deal that Jeter Downs came to the Dodgers in, which was an example, actually, of a team that was very much contending, making a trade where the focus for them was on, you know, some pieces that could help them down the road. And you look at, you know, those pieces became for them, you know, Mookie Betts and Max Scherzer and Trey Turner. There's different things that can happen, different good things that can happen when you're willing to take a step back, look at the bigger picture and act accordingly. And I think the Dodgers are reaping the rewards of having done that a couple of years ago when they acquired those two guys.
I want to ask you this one. One of your predecessors, Ben Cherington, had a term and he would say the next great Red Sox team. When do you think you will be able to build the next great Red Sox team, or have you already done it? Is it this year?
Well, I hope we look back at this year when it's all said and done and feel that we did. But you know, we look at, you know, we should always be in the process of building that. We want to get to the point where we are both fielding it and building it and sustaining it, you know, for the future. Look, we came into this, you know, when I got here, basically saying we want to make sure that we are putting a winning product on the field that we can be proud of, and that we are building this in such a way that the future gets brighter and brighter. And I think, you know, so far this year, obviously there's still some chapters of the 2021 story yet to be written, but I think we're in a stronger position when you look out ahead beyond this year. And we put a really entertaining club on the field that you know, hopefully we'll be able to finish this off and get to the postseason. So, you know, on that front, we feel good about what we've done, but, you know, we're not going to be satisfied until we get to the very top of the mountain, until we're in a position where we have a team every year that both we and our community looks at and feels like it has a real chance to do that. So, you know, I don't necessarily look at it as much in terms of timetables. I hope we're always going to be able to do that. And I think the way we get there is just by stacking one good move on top of another as much as we can, keeping our focus on saying we need an elite organization top to bottom. We put ourselves in position to have a lot of success, to try to win a championship every year. And I think doing that and keeping the focus on doing that is the best way to win those championships.
And last one for you, you've been so generous with your time. Just when you look at a guy like Xander Bogaerts, he has this opt-out, you know, coming up after the 2022 season. Do you see him as a foundational piece? And I think we all know where that shortstop market has moved to with the Francisco Lindor deal, 10 years, $341 million. Is that the type of investment you would be comfortable making, generally speaking, not exact numbers, generally speaking, in keeping a player?
Yeah, look, we're the Boston Red Sox. We shouldn't take anything off the table like that. You know, like I said, I think we should have access to the whole menu. Obviously, you know, we will, you know, cross that bridge when we come to it. But, you know, I don't need to tell you. I think everybody in this organization knows how important Bogey is here. All of our fans know how important he is. He's not just a great player. He's the type of person you want wearing your uniform. You know, I hope he always does. And, you know, first things first, let's get him back and see how far we can go with him this year. But, you know, there's no question. I mean, when you have a player like that, a person like that, you want to keep him here as long as you can.
All right. That is Chaim Bloom, Chief Baseball Officer of the Boston Red Sox. Chaim, thank you for joining us very much here on the Take Five podcast. Good luck the rest of the way. These final 20 games should be very, very exciting. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take Five podcast. We appreciate it as always. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast so others can find it and enjoy it. And now you can email us at take5@wcvb.com. We'd love to get your feedback and hear your thoughts. We'll catch you next time.